Okay, folks, I'd like to welcome you all to the Dark Occulted Mysticism Show with Vinnie Eastwood and Freighter X. Freighter, welcome, bro.
Hey, greetings. Greetings to all.
Now, we have no real plan for this particular show, other than the title would suggest we're going to try to talk about a little bit of something dark, something occulted, and something a little bit mystic. Now, I was wondering, we talked about with James Wright, for instance, about the 33rd degree of the Scottish Rite. And what I've ascertained, essentially, from him and also from you, is that in order to attain that level, to be a 33rd degree Freemason of the Scottish Rite, of the Supreme Council, you have to be corrupt. Yeah, especially if you're in a position of power, like a politician or something of that nature. Would you concur with that?
I would. I would say that the degree itself is corrupt by nature, and it's also a vengeance degree. It's all about vengeance, from what I understand. But yeah, it's totally corrupt because you have to have something they want, you know, like fame or money or political power or something that they want, or you buy your way in straight up, you know, like paying thousands of dollars for a white cap. It looks like a little bellboy's cap, basically. But like the black cap that James wears in his photo, but it's white and it has a different eagle on it.
Now, it's interesting. You see that symbolism all over the place. Like, I'm a fan of Warhammer 40K. I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but it's different models and stuff like that with space marines and some kind of distant future. And the Imperium of Man has the Freemason double-headed eagle, which is the isn't that a symbol for the 33rd degree of the Scottish Rite?
Yeah, I would say that's probably one of those things like, SRI imprinting going on there, you know, like with Masonic imagery. Like, if I really think there's something to that. I could even say I'm starting to believe that my own attraction to Freemasonry might be as a result of, intelligence seeding, you know, if you will, through pop culture, you know, by having the imagery everywhere. You know, it makes one more susceptible when you're growing up watching TV, movies, everything that, you know, video games, for example, now, you know, filled with these images. You're going to be drawn to certain ones and repelled by others. So, but yeah, I mean, it's totally the symbol. You've seen on vodka, a Smirnoff bottle has a double-headed eagle on it. And that's from, you know, Russia, right, supposedly. And then, I mean, it's everywhere. It's on all kinds of stuff. I think it's on the peppermint schnapps bottle, too, which is German, you know? So.
Yeah, and I was looking at these other things, like corporate logos, like Burger King, for example. You know how they have that swish around the buns with the Burger King in the middle? I was like, hey, that's Saturn.
Oh, yeah, all you got to do is watch, like, a couple of Freeman's films, you know, his DVDs there. Or any of the other, you know, there's a bunch of them out there that go through, have done the research to just point out. So that was an eye-opener, that very first video series that Freeman put out in the 90s, I guess, or just around the turn. Like, it wasn't the 90s, I guess, but it was, like, 2005 or 2006. And it was just set the Freeman perspective on it. It had the cover that was the same as his TV show. And that one there, I mean, he went through all those symbols from corporate media. I was like, wow, you know, never right there, hidden in plain sight all around. And then, you know, you go through that and then you start walking around and seeing it everywhere over and over again. Now it's like amazing to me, you know, all the kids shows and the movies and everything. It's just everywhere. But now going back to that Stargate conspiracy. You know, read that book. It's in there on like page 350 or something. They talk about the Stanford Research Institute's paper, where they basically and to paraphrase, what they say is that humanity is going to go through a cultural shift in consciousness, and they can't stop it, but there's ways to lead it or guide it or influence it. And that's the whole basis, according to the researchers that put that book together. That's the whole basis of that's their interpretation of the report, is that they were saying that they could use Masonic Egyptian motif and iconography and symbolism in order to captivate the viewing audience, you know, as it were.
There's another thing that I've been interested in finding out. You know, a lot of people have those predictions of 2012 and a consciousness shift and overthrow or maybe disaster or blah, 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 blah. I would think you know, if any of that was true, the elite would be preparing for it hand over fist if it was a disaster. I would think if it was true, they'd be subverting human consciousness to no end. Like, basically, they're planners and schemers, and they don't allow anything to happen by accident that they don't control. And so when people tell me that, Vinny, you're going to turn into a light being that's going to see all auras and such and such and such on December 21st, 2012, or, Planet X and Lucifer is going to come into view and it's going to throw the Earth off its axis by 23 degrees and crush everything and make fire and water go everywhere and tidal waves and this kind of stuff. Vinny, blah, 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 blah. It's just like, well, hold on a second here. They've got projected agendas out goodness knows how many years. I'd say at the least 30, they have specific plans years in advance. Things that they're going to be doing on specific dates and things like that. They're big believers in Kabbalah, and they have an innate sense of timing. So I'm just wondering, is this 2012 thing, is anything actually really going to happen?
I don't buy it. I had a guest on, John Michael Greer, that wrote a book called Apocalypse Not, and his research really convinced me, and it's all cross-referenceable, you know. But basically, I mean, if you listen to the calendrical researchers, those who research calendars and stuff, they talk about how we're already totally out of touch. We're in a discordant timeline anyways. We're not. It's really more like probably 1,000. AD than 2000 right now, according to the researcher I've looked at. I mean, we're in a strange little time loop here. I mean, how can you? I don't know. I just find it silly. I think it's a good diversion. I don't buy it. I've listened to that show.
That's been my contention all along. Yeah. Is that
it's one
the New World Order kind of blow these references out of proportion, allow it to get out there that there's going to be these events and such and such and such, so everybody will basically stand down and just go, oh, don't worry about these ruthless criminal sociopathic mofos that control everything. We're going to turn into aura sensors and everything's going to be better.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and it's such a, like, there's just a small little, I mean, according to John Michael Greer's work, you know, it's one reference. It's one or two small references in the big corpus of material that they still have to look at. Another thing that people never make this very obvious connection is someone along the way has crisscrossed two cultures here. We've got Aztec and Mayan culture woven together in this prophecy and this whole urban legend. Well, I think it's the Mayan belief and the Aztec calendar or something. I mean, whenever you hear it referenced in mainstream, it's always this weird hybridization of the two, which is in and of itself seems like a tremendous tell. And then there's just the fact that it's so tidy for, like, anything the History Channel can saturate on us, man. Anything that's just so easily workable from their angle, I immediately suspect. I'm sorry. You know what I mean? It's just, you know, if it can be televised and, you know, we can commercial breaks and everything going in there, it's just like, come on. You know what I mean? It's just like when we're getting back to the 33rd degree, every time they ever talk about Freemasonry, it's the same four guys that are all 33rd degree Scottish Rite Supreme Council. Well, I mean, as I've pointed out, as James Wright's pointed out, and as nobody else seems to want to talk about, but it's true, all you got to do is investigate it. The Scottish Rite Supreme Council is not Freemasonry, yet every time we hear about Freemasonry, they're the guys that are doing the talking. What the heck is going on there?
Yeah, well, but they're attempting to seize power over the mystery schools, I think. There's many, many mystery schools out there and things like that that actually may or may not have genuine objectives. I haven't looked into it ridiculously hard, but what I see is just simply a power grab. It's the same thing that goes all the way out through history between different factions of any group. One group eventually decides that they're not going to follow rules in order to gain dominance over the other.
Yeah, it's like you said, it is a power grab, and it is a playbook of rewriting the history in order to assume authority over the history. And just like with Soviet-style Russia, what happens in the end is you have a thing with no substance. You have a thing in which, like, for example, in Freemasonry, I just read the latest Grand Secretary's report from a major jurisdiction in America, and they're assessing the situation as most of the members, they have this no progress membership rate. So in other words, a guy comes into the lodge and he becomes a first degree, entered apprentice, and then he never comes back. Huh, what's going on there? They have a high number of people doing that. You know why? Because they realize there ain't nothing there for them. It's just a bunch of old guys that are playing bridge and drinking coffee and gossiping. And that's all it is. And they came in wanting higher knowledge. They wanted ancient wisdom in modern times, like Freemasonry advertises. They wanted the, you know, ancient light in modern time. And so basically,
I was wondering, Freda, what if you and James got together and created a new lodge?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's actually, as a matter of fact, there is in the works. It's not something I'm doing, but James is already involved in an international project, you know, doing that he's going to be speaking more about as time goes on. I can't really divulge, you know, I've been sworn to secrecy, as the case may be, but
how ironic! You're a Freemason, yeah, right. Sworn to secrecy,
but right. You know, that's why guys talk to me. They know I can keep a secret, right? You know,
yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah.
But you, by the time you get to where I've at, I've already gone through like 20 different obligations, oaths of obligation, Vinny. Like 20 different, you know. So if anybody can follow the secret-keeping pack, you'd assume a guy like me could. Now, having said that, the greatest thing about the situation is with anything esoteric and symbolic, most of the times the answers and the truths are never directly spoken to you. It's always implied. Therefore, all the most important factors that I have learned, I can tell anyone if they ask the right questions. It's all about how you ask the questions, because most of the stuff that I've – the most important things that I could share about lodge systems and, you know, all this was not taught to me inside the lodge, was not presented to me in during a ritual, during a degree. It was never under obligation. So I can talk about it, but I just can't present it without being asked the right questions. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's really the way it is.
Well, it sounds like, for example, have you ever seen the movie iRobot?
Yes.
Okay. You know, in the start when there's the old guy that's dead on the floor on the ground floor of the robotics center, and he has a digital hologram of himself talking to Detective Spoon, you know, Will Smith. And he says, "Why would you kill yourself?" And he goes, "I'm sorry, or something like that." He says, "I'm sorry, you must ask the right questions." And then when he does ask a question, it's like, "Who would want to kill you?" And he says, "That is the right question." But he doesn't give him an answer. He simply makes him aware that he's asking the right question.
Because through that, he gains understanding of the pattern. And that's a good point. Very good point. Yeah. And it is along those lines. And it's one of those things that people are listening, man. People are always listening. And like I've already said in the past, I want to maintain the status I have in order to be in the room, because somebody from our side has to be in the room. You know, if anybody's ever going to find out what's going on, if anything ever comes down, or if anybody's ever going to be in a position to make a difference. I mean, some would say, oh, well, that's impossible because you're inside of a corrupt system. Well, I mean, aren't all human systems corrupt? I mean, don't we find that everywhere you look, you find the same kind of – my point is that, all right, like in a jungle, you've got 1,000 varieties of insects in a jungle, right? Only 100 of them are venomous, you know what I mean? The other 900 are beautiful and strange and weird and annoying and whatever, but they're not venomous. Like, only 100 of them are or whatever. You see what I mean? So there's like 900 other varieties there that are not harmful, that are actually beautiful, you know? I don't know if that makes sense, but that's my thinking on that.
Well,
so let's move on.
It comes to that analogy about a stagnant pond and where the scum tends to sit, always tends to gravitate towards the top. And if scum's sitting on the top of a pond, all the other organisms beneath it, be they fish, be they krill, be they some other form of crustacean, they require the sunlight to come through the surface of the water in order to survive. And I see this as a metaphor for our current society, is that the light may be representing knowledge, truth, wisdom, justice, whatever positivity you wish to spin on it. I don't really believe in labels anymore because they're all fake. But the other side of it is, how exactly does somebody who has had all their power, all their ability to survive, covered over, breach through, and remove that top film of scum? And I think that it's more the fact of just identifying what it is that's blocking you to allow you to thrive is the first step. And at the moment, Freemasonry is not widely known as in any form of truth or fact or verifiable evidence to the average punter. You know, they don't know what the number 33 means. They don't know anything. Literally, they don't notice the all-seeing eye pyramids and stuff like that. They don't notice the big Masonic penises in the middle of all of their cities and stuff like that, and public squares and giant buildings. they don't know that. They don't know about.
Oh, more importantly, Vinny, Freemasonry is not serving Freemasons as it once did. It's not. That's my whole contention, is that it's been usurped. It was a failure. This whole experience was a failure, in the sense that my original purpose for getting involved in Freemasonry was not fulfilled. The ultimate purpose was not fulfilled. The ultimate purpose was to reconnect with what I believed a heritage of wisdom that I thought was being kept unbroken down through the ages. But what I found instead is the same kind of elitist, you know, secularization and marginalization and insulated, you know, dichotomy and all the other dynamics that go along with separatism and elitism and oligarchic ways. I mean, it's all right there. It's same mentality. It's a microcosmic example of what's going on the government level, on the global level, on the, you know, it's all the same.
It's blocking out the goodness so that it cannot grow. I mean, that's essentially what I've seen.
It took over the goodness, and it tied the goodness up and put it in the closet with no sunlight, and it put this fake Christmas tree out, a plastic version, and said, "There it is. There's the goodness. Everybody come and put your money down and worship the goodness right there." You know,
it's like the Manchurian candidate.
Yeah, it's like everything's counterfeit. Everything's counterfeit. I mean, our culture too. We've all, like, it's all a series of, like, coercive, like, we're raised.
When you say everything's counterfeit, it reminds me of one of the main principal tenets of Satanism. It's to turn everything upside down.
Yeah, well, our culture has become that. Like, I firmly believe that Mark Passio is right on to something when he says that they're creating a satanic society. Because, and I look at my own family members, man, they're so self-absorbed. It's all about them. It's all hedonistic self-absorption. I mean, it's ridiculous. And when I question, man, I don't know if you're a listener to the Passio show there, what on earth is happening, but it's on Sundays. And he, way back on a last year, he posed a question that I took out and started asking people, because I thought it was an interesting sociological experiment. And what it was is, he said, go around and ask people whether they think that there is, in fact, an ultimate, like, cosmic justice out there. Like, if you violate the tenets of, say, natural law, you know, the seven principles of natural law, if you violate this tenet, is there an ordered justice to things? You know, that was the question. So if a human, is there a system of right and wrong that if a human violates that, there will be a consequence? Like, there will be a metaphysical psychic price to pay, whether you perceive it as that or not. It is there. You know, is that true? And so, like, I went to my own family and to people who I thought, you know, people who raised me, who I thought would surely say yes, that there was, in fact, cosmic, you know, justice, and that there was this sense of, you know, good, a moral, you know, principle by which the universe was guided and by which humanity had to adhere, whether it liked it or not. Everyone I asked said no. Everyone I asked said no. They didn't think that there was anything that could stand between you and the worst act that you could commit to get ahead. I was like blown away by it. I mean, it's the implications are tremendous to me. It's like, I mean, I said, are you kidding me? Are you really don't think so? I mean, I was shocked because I do believe that there are certain things that, that we, when we cross certain lines, there is an effect, whether we perceive it or not, because I think that we've been dulled to, we've been dulled to the effect. It doesn't mean it's not there. It just means we cannot perceive it anymore. We've been dulled to it. It's been closed off to us. That's the effect, though, I think, that we've, that we're, that, that part of us that, that, that senses something's wrong. You know what I mean? That, that well, we really
there's,
know.
There's so many inputs. I mean, just taking health and the amount of toxins, poisons that are deliberately put into our food supply alone. Particularly dehydration. Dehydration is a very interesting one. Can you think of any fast food, any soft drink, or any sports drink, or anything really that is mass-produced that a lot of people consume that doesn't dehydrate you?
No, I can't. And that's
not,
why
not off the top of your head. You know, you'd have to look for it. And here's the point: when you're thirsty, you can't think. Even so much as a minor bit of dehydration. Reduces your thinking capacity extraordinarily large amounts. So if we've got an entire dehydrated society, then it's no wonder that they've been detached from these things that would require thought, reflection, to perceive.
And then they've even further, you know, alchemical interference with all the strange synthetic products that have been leached, all the food supply has been leached through these strange products, that these additives and natural flavorings and all these things that they process the food with. I mean, everything's processed with it. It's the craziest thing. You know, even when you go into the so-called healthy food side and look through these products, and it's like, oh yeah, I'm going to grab this. And then you start looking and, you know, in fact, wow, not so healthy. There's some stuff in there, maybe not so healthy. And it's all the whole organic labeling. I mean, it's so silly. It's not true.
Well, that's funny as well. A couple of weeks ago, bro, we had a study come out of Stanford University saying that organic foods don't have any more nutritional value than non-organic foods. And the interesting thing that I found about this is that the interviewer, James Coleman, who's a mainstream reporter guy here, kept trying to hammer that point home. They're not any better. And the person from Stanford was trying to elaborate on it and saying, well, technically there ain't much extra nutrients in the foods and what have you, but the organics are not contaminated by pesticides and herbicides and other toxic things that cause cancer, organ failure, etc. later in life. And he closes off the show by saying, yep, thank you very much for all that information. Remember, everybody, organic foods aren't any good and it's a scam.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what I was going to say, though, is that in the 90s, I distinctly recall them it being a topic of talk radio discussion, as a matter of fact. And what was the topic? That they were that organic as a label, as a term, had been, you know, basically co-opted by commercial food production, and it was like being allowed, that they had changed the standards for what it meant for something to be called organic in the marketplace in order to allow the big companies to be able to put their products in organic containers. And it was like the people who were in the organic food industry at the time were saying, this is what everyone was saying to me, we need to come up with a new term for organic because organic isn't true anymore. And then it all just went away. Like, they stopped talking about it. I mean, it just became accepted. It just quietly got accepted. Everybody's got organic stuff on the shelves, and, you know, we all just, because it says organic on the label, we just assume it's true. It's ridiculous, you know.
Yeah, that's another thing that the woman from Stanford mentioned, is that a minimum of 10% of organic produce has pesticides and herbicides on it, anywhere up from 10 to 20%.
Just from being out in the growing in the
no. More the fact that the organic laws and requirements for labeling are so lax.
Yes, there it is.
That even in the United States, to be organic means 90% organic. Right?
Exactly. See, that's the point. Is that it was they changed it so they could be able to work with it and be able to market their products. You know,
exactly. So we only have 10% herbicides and pesticides that we normally have in our regular products, except it's like 4 times as expensive.
And now we're talking about the minimum government allowance. You know, that's the term. You know, minimum government allowance, MGA. Minimum. That should be a band name or something. You know,
minimum government. Mitt Romney could be one of the front men. You know, like refugee unit.
The guy could wear a Mitt Romney mask while he sang. That's what should happen there. But I wanted to bring up a couple other things, man. Like for example. This whole thing with the detainees from Guantanamo who are right out of Australia. Have you heard about this guy, David Hicks? He was held in like Guantanamo for I'm not sure for how long. It's probably right here in the article. But the things that happened to him during this time, it was basically that it seems as if the pharmaceutical companies were. I know this is hard to believe, right? But they were using detainees as lab rats and using this stuff called. Methaguine or some sort of strange malaria drug that they were using as a form of pharmacological waterboarding. Okay?
I.e. force drugging.
Yeah, force drugging detainees. And, you know, of course, all this was been covered up. But right now, the Sydney, Morning Herald, I guess, they've got witnesses that are corroborating this guy through independent investigations, right? Now the details of this mistreatment is coming out, and the Australian government's they were going to go forward, but it seems as if it's abandoned its case now. But it's coming back in for a second time to a properly constituted court. I mean, just you know the usual shuffling around of stuff. But the fact of the matter is that they show that these guys, these detainees in Guantanamo, I mean, what we're talking about here is what seems to me like modern MK Ultra on steroids is what it is. You know, I mean, they're just doing, and the pun is intended, and that basically now they're just doing all the same kind of testing that they were doing all along under the auspices of, war on terror,
well,
right?
That's what terrorism actually is. It's a system of government that uses fearful, violent, and coercive tactics in order to get the population to behave the way it wants them to.
And I believe that letting this article out even, people will say, well, what, that was true. Well, then why would they let that article be published, right? I'll tell you why they let that article be published. It scares the pants off anybody who reads it. And they say, I don't want to mess with that government that'll put me in one of those melanocortin, you know, malaria drug, you know, stupors.
I'm going to keep my head down.
Yeah, I like my.
I'm not going to stand up and protest and try and do what's justice and right and stuff like that. I'll get murdered.
Yeah, I'll have to sleep in a dirty tent with a bunch of little hippies and weirdos and stuff. And, you know, I'm not one of them. I'm not out there entitling. I'm not somebody who thinks I should be entitled to things. Of course, Mitt Romney's not somebody who thinks he should be entitled to things either. But it turns out his children, in fact, are, I guess, entitled. Because Mitt and his wife put a little sizable account set up for them. They put, $1 million into this money. One of these, like, accelerated money growth markets that only the rich and wealthy and powerful get access to, you know. But basically, they turned $1 million into $100 million, and their three kids all divide it equally, $33 million, and they live
Of course, 33 million.
Right, it's 33 million each, living off it for the rest of their lives. By the way, but I don't know. I guess we don't call that entitlement, even though it really sounds like it to me. I mean, they're, you know, all set, though, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I've always wondered about this because, you know, I had an opportunity to have a big inheritance, but it turns out that me and all my brothers and sisters and everything were basically disowned when I was, like, 9 years old by dad and stuff like that. And now it's all in a trust and with all these beneficiaries and stuff like that. So basically, if anybody wants anything, everybody has to get everything. So if I go and ask for 10K or something like that, what I'm actually asking for my wedding or whatever, What I'm actually asking for is $140K off the trust that they'll have to give out to everybody in order to do it. So basically, the bottom line is nobody gets anything ever, right? So I'm really ticked about that. So I'm wondering what's the balancing act here between inheritance and what it actually is meant for. What is it supposed to do for you? Because if you pass massive inheritance down and down and down the scale in a corrupt family type fashion, they will keep using corruption in order to maintain their dominance over the world that they've been in control of for so long.
I don't know the answer to the question, Vinny. I got to be honest. I wonder about it myself because I think that it's a dangerous trap. It's easy for, you know, you well, just
and,
don't.
And the communists have this thing as well. They say that your inheritance or whatever gets taken by the state, something along those lines.
Yeah, here in America, that's one of those slave issues that we get to fight about is inheritance taxes. A tax on inheritance. They have a whole big. It's a big deal, man. It's something there. It's called. I can't remember that. There's a term for it. Somebody in the chat and Skype will probably type it up. But there's a term for the basic debate there. But it is. They have a huge tax even in America on legacy tax is what it's called. Legacy tax. And they have a huge tax in America still that people are constantly debating this issue because people are, you know, the current mindset, I believe, of most socialized, democratic, socialized governments, including America, is that you should be taxed greater for your legacy money than for regular income because you didn't do anything for it, I guess, is what they're saying, you know. That's the socialized progressive view, you know.
See, I don't like that either because I don't want the government taking my money away from my kids.
Yep, that's what I think too.
Right, you know, but also it makes it incredibly unfair for the people who have no inheritance. They're screwed.
I know, man. It's rough.
It's impossible nowadays, not hard, but impossible for people to become financially secure to the point where they'll actually own their house, own their car, and be able to actually and have $100K or $200K or whatever tucked away to pay for their funeral and give some inheritance out to their children and stuff like that. That's not possible anymore.
Well, let's talk about that. Why? Why is that not possible? I'll tell you why. Because in the end, Vinny, I don't think that's what's supposed to matter. I mean, the Taoists, after you pass 40, the old belief, the old approach from what I understand was you gave up your career and everything and went off into the woods and lived like a mystic hermit till you died. You became one with the Tao. You gave everything up. You let go of all the material attachments and went off and lived in a cave or whatever. I mean, that's the thinking. I mean, I think that there might be some wisdom to that. I got to be honest. Call me a kook. But I think that that's the fact that we, like Manly P. Hall, his big thing was, his whole motivating factor for writing all of his works, he said, was because there was a real struggle between the material and the spiritual. And we were focused, dead set, all the time on the material now in modern culture. It's like materialism gone haywire. And I think that there's something to be said for that. And that's why, you know...
Well, the globalists have socially engineered us into that type of mentality. We're always being flashed with hot women, hot food, hot cars, hot mortgages, you know, that kind of thing. Gimme, gimme, gimme right now, that kind of thing. And who are the people that finance all of this? It's the criminal bankster elite.
I totally agree.
What if it was incredibly specific? If there was a law against inheritance or something that taxed inheritance or something like that, I would think that the bar would have to be set ridiculously high to only encompass the super, super rich. Like somebody who's got $100 million doesn't qualify. Somebody who's got $1 billion plus, yeah.
Well, that's it too. I mean, isn't that really the reality we see that all of our whole world's like that? I can't remember who said it. It might have been Max or no, I think it's what's his name? You know, the guy, the sovereignty guy there,
Eric Lovely.
No, Dean Clifford.
Oh, yeah.
Dean Clifford, he says, it's not our system. This isn't our system. That's why it doesn't work. The system was not designed for us. It was not. We are. This system was designed to separate you and me from our money. Whatever money we accumulate, it is designed to separate us from it. And it's our the whole mission. That's why you sense it. You know it's a no-win situation. You know we can't win because it's not supposed to be. The only way you win is by sheer luck. Sheer luck. That's it, I think. Or you're part of that elite that this system is for you. It was designed for you, and that's why you win. Because you're in that 1%, you know what I mean?
Well, you know, and that 1% mentality, that's actually the about the percentage of geniuses that we have in our society, isn't it?
Yeah, it's weird because I don't think that these guys are geniuses, frankly. I mean,
well,
that's not what I'm saying.
What I'm saying is that they hire all the geniuses to do all this stuff for them. Who runs all this wealth? Not them.
Nope, you're right.
Okay, they got commission management. If you run this company and you run it well and you make X amount of extra dollars this year than you did last year, then you will get a commission of that profit as a reward for your superior managerial skills. That's commission management. That's how the Rothschilds do it. It's how the Rockefellers do it. They can't be bothered running all this stuff. They'd rather just be running around to secret meetings and stuff like that and having sex with gay porn stars.
Yeah, and also, you know, it's all set up so that, like, you know, there's insular education systems. Like, for example, a big secret here, everybody thinks, oh, you know, Cinderella story, Bill Gates, you know, rises to the top as, like, the head of the PC world and all this stuff. Well, let me tell you something. Bill Gates went to one of the richest high schools in the world, man. I mean, when he was a kid, him and his classmates had access to the original building size processors called UNIVACs, the old computers that were the size of buildings with vacuum tubes and like punch cards. And these kids were allowed to crawl all over these things and upload their own algorithms and figure out how computers worked. So, of course, they're going to have an advantage over everyone else to understand all this, you know, what's coming.
And
because
so naturally,
they were given access.
And so naturally, because they've had the access, because they've got the extra knowledge, and basically they hit the ground running, whereas others have to be completely dependent. It's kind of like a baby, right? Imagine a baby is born and it's able to talk and it's able to walk and it's able to take care of itself from birth. That's the equivalent of what I'm talking about here between how the elite are born into the world versus how the rest of the population is. They hit the ground running. We still have to be completely and utterly dependent for a long period of time and slowly learn those things, whereas they're given it just like that. They didn't earn anything. And I think that gives them a sense of narcissistic entitlement, which is part of the reason why you see any legislation, you see any action being taken by any of these globalists in any way, and it always embodies that I don't have to earn it, I'll just steal it type of mentality, because that's how I've learned. I will not have to do anything. I won't have to do any good. I will simply be given everything, and all I have to do in order to have that is do exactly as I'm told.
And that was like my original point. How is that not entitlement? And these are the kind of guys that will stand up and say that they're against entitlement. I mean, Romney, I mean, you know, in case, let's go over it again in case anybody's unclear. Bain Capital, this is a company that makes money by creating debt, everyone. That's how it makes money. See, it puts its eyes on a company that it wants, like, for example, Dunkin' Donuts. Bain Capital and the Carlyle Group both took over Dunkin' Donuts a few years back and basically did what they do, which is to siphon off all the wealth of Dunkin' Donuts to the point where now Dunkin' Donuts has to sell 1 million cups of coffee a month just to keep the doors open. That's even before profits, because of what Bain and Carlyle did. And what they do is this. They see, okay, this company's got a lot of assets and they've got some kind of problem going on. So they go and they borrow money. There's your debt creation right there. So Romney and his buddies, they all throw in, you know, 500,000 pocket cash each, come up with a couple million. They go to a big bank or lending company and they say, hey, we need $100 million to go buy up Dunkin' Donuts, and we'll give you guys $500 million out of their assets once we suck them out. What do you say? And those guys were like, here you go, buddy. What, you know, where can we sign? Here we go. Boom. They give them $100 million. They go over, and they leverage buyout Dunkin' Donuts, and the first thing they do is tell them, oh, yeah, by the way, now you owe these guys $500 million. Because that's the debt that you assume because we now own your company and we had to borrow the money to get your company, so now you have to pay it back. Oh, and by the way, me and all of our shareholders, we need our dividends up front before you pay them back too. And all of our bonuses and everything for quote-unquote saving your company. That's what Bain Capital does to a company. That's creating debt, people. That's not a businessman. Well, that is predatory lending.
Yeah, yeah, that's
predatory,
right.
Predatory practicing.
Vulture capitalism, and this is something.
Vulture capitalism.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, I'm reading, still reading Vulture's Picnic by Greg Palast, about 100 pages in. And for all the readers out there, Greg Palast, BBC reporter, oh, man, he's a guest to have. I wish we could get him on because he is amazing. But he's like Seymour Hersh meets Jack Kerouac meets Sam Spade. You know, I mean, and basically what I've gotten out of this so far is that there was, you know, BP totally implicated in the Gulf War, the rigging that blew up. They had a gas blowout in the Caspian Sea long before the Gulf. They knew it was coming. They knew nitrogen cement, the cheap ass cement they were using, was not going to hold, and they didn't care. They polluted the Gulf of Mexico, and they didn't even care. And they tried to make it like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about.
They did that after purchasing the world's largest oil cleanup company, Boots and Coots, 11 days prior.
Yeah, and also, who was the contractor, by the way, who poured the cement for those platforms?
Halliburton.
Halliburton, ladies and gentlemen, who just came up in the news again this past week. Anybody who didn't see, Halliburton, it seems, lost a tiny little fracking tool. Guess what this little fracking tool is, Vinny? A nuclear rod.
Oh.
Yes.
I was gonna wonder if it was used for sodomy of the workers when they've been naughty.
Maybe that's what happened. We don't know. All we know is that on September 11th, everyone, a three-man team of Halliburton oil field workers lost a radioactive rod, according to the state impact, you know, local public media, NPR source that I've got. I just put it in the chat room or in the chat box of Skype for the other listeners. But they lost it somewhere between Pecos and... oh, you know, the cruise destination south of Odessa. So I guess they lost it in Texas. Oh, that's you know, thanks, Halliburton. We appreciate you.
How exactly did that happen? Well, hold on a second. What were these dudes in a pickup truck or something pulling donuts in a field with shotguns and malt liquor?
According to the report, the tool, which is basically it's a device that's used as it's a sensor. It's a nuclear-sensitive sensor or whatever, right? So it's an actual piece of nuclear radiation used for coal seam fracking, okay? So the tool was in the back of their truck, and at some point they noticed that the truck's lock wasn't in place, and it was in the back of the truck, and the rod was missing. So they don't even know if it was stolen or fell out or what. But the rod is used in a drilling process called fracking, where they lower it down into wells to find the best place to break up shale to release the oil and gas deposits. So the rod somehow is part of this process. But they said that, you know, the rod is diminutive. It's maybe 7 inches long, not much bigger than a new iPhone. I guess Apple had to get a little product placement into this article, right? But it's encased in a steel container, and it does pack something of a punch, the article says, though. The rod is not something that produces radiation in an extremely dangerous form, but it is best for people to stay back 20 to 25 feet. Well, if you can't go near it...
Whoa. What's the pickup truck and the dudes in it? What the frick is their excuse if they ain't allowed to be in 25 feet? What are you going to do? Get a frickin' semi to have it right on the other back end of you with a big sign that says don't come within 25 meters of us?
I don't know. I guess we're supposed to get lost in that puzzle instead of paying attention to the details of this article. Because I don't know. That doesn't make any sense. But here's what they say. Okay, I got to read a little bit more because this is really amazing. The radioactive material in the rod is called americium. Americium, I don't know, Americium 241.
Or it sounds like a pornographic element, like Americum.
Exactly, it almost looked like that. And beryllium, or AM241.
Yeah.
No, it's americium 241 / beryllium, so it's all the same element. It's classified as a Category 3 source of radiation by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. That means that if it's not safely managed, quote-unquote, or securely protected, it could cause permanent injury to a person who handled them or otherwise came into contact with them for some hours. It could possibly, although it is unlikely, be fatal to be close to this amount of unshielded radioactive material for more than the days or weeks, more than a couple. So in other words, let's get this straight. If there's a house 10 feet away from the road where the thing fell out on the ground, these people are probably in serious trouble. But it turns out that the federal bureau, they love throwing these official agency names down in this article too, like the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, has, and this is in bold blue writing, anybody reading along, cleared Halliburton of any criminal activity. The crew didn't
Can
stop.
Can I ask, how much is that rod worth?
That's a good question. It doesn't say so in the article. I'm sure it'd be easy to find out, but no answer here.
Because you take Howard Hughes and the drill bits that he invented back in the day in order to drill for oil. Nobody else could come up with comparable technology the way he did. So they've been renting out those drill heads for $50,000 an hour or a day or something ridiculous. So, you know, any kind of resource extraction, particularly oil extraction, the tools that are used in the industry, remarkably expensive. You know, these aren't just things you can pick up at a hardware store. And if it's radioactive and it's used for testing all of this kind of stuff, you know, that could have been a $1 million device that's this big that's smaller than the new iPhone, as it were. So, you know, there's also the possibility of insurance fraud. And I wouldn't put it past Halliburton. There's also the possibility of perhaps selling it to a bidder or something. In fact, they probably wouldn't sell it, all right, because it'd be traceable, detectable, stuff like that, wouldn't it? I don't know. Maybe it's just some accident, some stupid redneck fracks working for Halliburton fracked up again.
Or maybe it's some domestic terrorist building himself a little dirty bomb. You know what I mean? Funded by a bunch of intelligence agencies in America. Who knows? I mean,
well,
this is
that's also
the freaky
another thing.
Part of it.
You can go back and you can do forensic what's it called? Forensic investigation back into people's past and that kind of stuff, and you'll find out that they bought this product there and that product there and blah 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 blah, and it's all RFID tagged and scanned and put in the analysis and everything like that, provided they used in any form of anything. And the other element that I have here is, well, it's just like anything that involves scumbaggery, that involves a company that is known to engage in scumbaggery, I don't think it's a stretch of the imagination that they probably orchestrated it.
Totally. And, you know, I don't know how this company remains in business, I mean, except for the corruption fact. I mean, it's got to be it. I mean, frankly, that's I'm sorry, I just got distracted. But anyways, I wanted to also bring up another subject if we've talked about this one enough.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, I recently watched a new version of, it's an old movie. It's called Apocalypse Now. I'm sure you've seen it.
Yeah, I got the DVD.
Have you seen the Redux from 2001 of Apocalypse Now?
Oh, yeah.
So you saw the extra 44 minutes?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't until just like last week. I had not seen this movie. And the reason why I bring it up is because it ties into something we said earlier about the Soviet-style approach to rewriting history and unwriting history and changing things and, you know, just like retelling events after the fact in such a way that you can almost like casually say it and it goes right under the radar. But if you had come out, you know, at the time, it would have been like an explosive thing. and somehow it's able, after, you know, 40 years or whatever, or 30 years as the case may be, to say the same thing, and it's like tacitly accepted. And one little example is in this movie, Apocalypse Now, for example. I don't know if you recall the extra scenes, but one of them was one where, well, of course there was the whole, first there was the scene where they come upon a French plantation, and there's all these guys that are like, they come out of nowhere. There's like it looks like a totally, a ruined villa on the river. And then all of a sudden there's just like guys everywhere with machine guns, and turns out they're French. And so the soldiers, Willard, played by Martin Sheen, and the other guys there, even Lawrence Fishburne, a young 17-year-old Lawrence Fishburne, you know, what's his name, Morpheus from The Matrix. But so they get off the boat. Never get off the boat, no. They get off the boat, and they have dinner with the French nationals. And what is this family who've been right there at that spot for like 80-something years, almost a whole century. And they've got like their whole ethnic identity woven into this Vietnamese area where, you know, they're surrounded by the Viet Cong, and they're like the white people that shouldn't be there, really, you know, but they won't go. And it's such an amazing scene. And the fact that they removed the scene from the movie, I think, is so telling for a couple reasons. Number one, it really has a character of like imperialism about it. It's so very imperialistic, the way that their stance is. They're, you know, they keep trying to play like the noble oblige, you know, like the obligation of the nobleman. Oh, we were always here just to help, you know what I mean? Like we tried to help these people, and how come they can't seem to understand that we're just here to help ourselves to all their resources? I mean, help them, right? You know, help them, yeah. But so at one point there, I don't know if you know the scene I'm talking about, Vinny?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So the point I'm trying to bring up to, I'm leading up to, is the point where the old patriarch of the household turns at one point and kind of like gets everybody's attention. And the whole film now focuses on this old guy. And he says, you know, way back in 1945. He goes, America. Huh. He's like, that's how he begins his commentary. You're like, America. Huh. Yeah, Americans. Back in 1945, you know, Roosevelt, after World War II, he decided he wanted to get rid of us, the French. He wanted to drive the French out. And, you know, as a little aside to everybody listening, my own research shows that, you know, the United States government did, in fact, sell all the surplus weapons they had, all the arms that weren't, you know, valuable to them, all the beat-up second-string arms they had on the docks in Okinawa, Japan, after World War II. They sold them all to Ho Chi Minh. And the old guy says in this thing, he says, America created the Viet Cong in 1945 to drive the French out of Vietnam. And Martin Sheen's character, Willard, you know, he like turns to the other guy and he's like, what the hell is he talking about? And the other guy's like, oh yeah, it's true. America created the Viet Cong. And, you know, like, it just sort of goes, we just move along in the scene to the opium smoking and gratuitous sex scene afterwards, you know. But wow, what, you know, it's just, that movie came out in 1979. That's 4 years after the fall of Saigon. And, you know, personally, I know, I grew up with the Apocalypse Now version that is not this version, 44 minutes cut out. It's the commercial version I think most people in America probably grew up with. And this version of the movie, this redux, it portrays – it's a better movie, frankly. It's a completely different movie, and it's way better than the movie I grew up with. And one of the reasons is because it's more honest. They're telling that part right there. The fact that they cut that scene out is so deplorable to me and so telling of – the real state of things. Our entire reality has been contrived. It's been sculpted and crafted to meet a certain specific paradigm. And this is it. You know, we're the good guys. They're the bad guys. We don't do things like that. Only they do. You know, when I was a kid, only the Russians were the torturers. The Cubans and the Russians and all the other, you know, evil dark-haired people with beards, they were only the ones that tortured. It was never, you know, the Americans, they were the good guys, right? Well, you know, that's just not the case. And, like, I worked for a guy one time who, he worked for Army Corps of Engineers during Vietnam in the 60s. And he was in places that he, you know, officially wasn't in, like Laos and Cambodia. His job was to build airstrips for Air America. And that was basically a front for the CIA. And he saw a whole bunch of stuff. And he also had cancer, that guy. He had cancer when I knew him. He already had cancer. He told me the most accurate movie. I thought this was outrageous when he told me. And it blew my mind. And I didn't realize till years later that he was right. I mean, I didn't realize how true he was until years later. But he told me the most accurate movie depicting Vietnam War was the movie called Air America with friggin' Mel Gibson and Robert Downey Jr. It was a comedy about those pilots who were flying those missions. But in that movie, I watched it again years later. They show scenes where they're stuffing heroin and opium into the body bags of the American soldiers and then shipping them back to America. That was the big point of that movie. That was the big secret of that movie. And in the movie, all the generals of South Vietnam were all opium warlords. And this guy told me that that was true. He said all the generals of Vietnam were all opium warlords. It was all about opium the whole time. And it was the who was going to control the poppy, you know. And, of course, we know historically that the CIA took a bunch of opiums from there and brought them to Colombia, you know, and from other places, too, and brought them to Colombia. But and then if you flash forward a little bit further into the modern era, or more modern than the 60s, you know, for when I was a young man, I knew another guy whose son was in the Air Force during these modern war conflicts. He was an airborne ranger, and he told his father a story about the same thing, that they were smuggling opium back from Afghanistan in body bags to America, and the Army was doing it. And he said that him and his buddies were talking about it one time, and three of the guys he was talking to all died in some kind of plane accident very shortly after that conversation. And then he himself had an attempt on his life, and after that ended up leaving the Army AWOL because of the, you know, fear, and a whole big dramatic experience that occurred. But anyways, the point is that there's something to all this stuff, you know. I mean, it doesn't take very much looking, you can just throw a rock and hit a pile of research that has indicated that there's far more going on with our armed forces than what we've been led to believe. And it's, you know, obviously, well, that's very clear.
That's why the first casualty of war is the truth. You cannot you cannot fight a war without killing the truth first.
Oh yeah, the truth is the first casualty of war. Absolutely. Before we wrap it up, though, I wanted to also bring up: have you heard about this new show, Revolution, Vinny?
No.
Oh, you haven't even heard about it?
I don't hear about a lot of stuff until the person comes on my show, bro.
Well, there's a new show on NBC called Revolution. Here's the breakdown: there's been a total power grid failure in America. I don't know if it's the whole world, but at least America, right? And it must be the whole world, but it's 15 years later, and there's a militia led by this guy that all in America, there's a government called the Republic of Monroe, and the militia like brands guys with the M on their flesh. And basically it's like Postman meets Highlander meets Red Dawn. Seriously. They even had a cameo of C. Thomas Howell wielding a sword in like the first 5 minutes of the second episode, you know what I'm saying? But the guy, the lead character's name is Miles Matheson, which Richard Matheson's the guy who wrote I Am Legend and the original Omega Man with Charlton Heston. He also wrote Nightmare at 20,000 Feet and What Dreams May Come. So it's like post-apocalyptic, and they're using Matheson. I can't help but think there's a little connection there. And the name Revolution, when they go to commercial break, it blanks out the R and it says Evolution, and then it says Revolution, and then the I or the O is the power symbol, like an electronic device. The O for Revolution is the power symbol. So like, and that flickers on and off like a symbol of power, you know, focus on the power symbol, you know, and the whole false sense of scarcity, you know, energy scarcity and shortage and all that. And then there's like all these strange things, you know, just the way that the commercials they have during it. And then it's definitely something to it'd be interesting to see the breakdown by somebody like Freeman or one of the other guys that does the real intense research of all the symbols there, because it seems chock full of it to me. You know what I mean? I recommend that.
Everything is. And this is there's no creativity left in Hollywood. Okay. And if you think there is, I got two words for you. Rocky Six.
Beverly Hills Cop 3.
Okay. They have lost every bit of credibility and creativity that had ever existed. Okay. They don't take risks. They go by a formula. Now, I have come to the conclusion that, well, basically, I can't tell the difference between the fiction that they're putting on the movie screen anymore from the fiction they tell me on the news. I don't know what's real anymore, because it's all fiction, isn't it? And it makes me confused about what the truth really is about anything. You know, this is why I've kind of come to the point where I've sort of accepted that I'll never know everything. And my whole idea behind living my life or being a good person or anything of that nature, basically, it doesn't exist. That's a fraud too. The best answer I can come up with for most things in this world is, I don't know. And those are my three favorite words, basically, because you can always fall back on them, because we freaking don't. And my three most hated words, on the other hand, which would be the one that would not cause you to question or cause you to go out, there's three words I hate hearing. I don't care. I think we better start caring. We better start looking. We better start listening. We better start questioning. Because I think if you don't question the nature of your reality, then you've got no sense of the possible, and then you've got no alternative to the lie. Right, Freda, I think this has been a very stellar show right here, the Dark Occulted Mysticism Show with Vinny Eastwood and Freda Rex. Thanks, bro.
Hey, thank you. And that was a great sentiment there at the end. I think that was a great way to end it. That's a good thing to leave people thinking about.
Mm-mm. You can check my show out, ladies and gentlemen, 5 days a week, 5 till 7 central at AmericanFreedomRadio.com, or visit the website TheVinnyEastwoodShow.com. All the shows are archived, and you can also catch Freda's show as well. Tell people about it, Freda.
The Middle Chamber is on Saturday nights on American Freedom Radio, and we have a new time now. We're 2 hours earlier now on Saturday nights, 6 p.m. Central Standard Time, as opposed to 8 p.m. as we were. We're sandwiched now in between two great new shows that are coming out on American Freedom Radio, which is Lifting the Veil with Carrie Lee, which starts at 4, and then the new Alex Ansari Outside the Box show, which starts in my old time slot at 8 o'clock. So I'm really excited, because I think I'll be able to get some new listeners from these other shows to check out the Middle Chamber while they're waiting to, you know, catch the shows that they're coming to listen to, you know?
Yeah, well, so, you know, we've got to all produce more content and as much cross-promotion and cross-pollination as we can do. And I've already scheduled our next week's show. The recording will be on Wednesday, the 3rd of October, and we will have Freeman stopping in for an hour.
Oh, you mean this is a show with us here?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. All right. Sounds good. All right. So October 3rd. And what time are we thinking?
Just after my show, 8 till 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Okay. We'll say 8-ish.
Yeah. I like the word-ish. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we will see you again-ish.
All right. Have a great one until we talk again, everybody. Thanks for listening.